It's a tale that sounds almost too good to be true. In the basement of a home in Middle America, a talented sound engineer named William Savory hoards hundreds of boxes of jazz recordings from the 30s and early 40s. These discs of live radio performances by greats like Billie Holiday, Benny Goodman, and Coleman Hawkins, and also interesting lesser-known musicians, could have had an impact on jazz history, but unfortunately no one was able to hear them until now. Thanks to the work of Lauren Schoenberg, the director of the National Jazz Museum in Harlem, these discs, known as the Savory Recordings, are finally being made public and are already changing the way we understand jazz's swing era. I'm very pleased to welcome Lauren Schoenberg back to our show today. And he's joined by Eugene Desivray, the son of William Savory. Welcome to both of you.
Good morning.
Hi, Eugene. Now, your name is it, am I pronouncing it right? Desivray?
It's pretty close. It's actually Desivray.
Desivray. Well, it's definitely not Savory. So your father, when did your father decide to change the name?
Well, he was born Savory. And then probably sometime in the 40s, he adopted Desivray.
Oh.
And I asked him what the deal was there. And he said he used Savory for business and Desivray for art.
Well, he's a guy who had a lot of different disguises. Hadn't he been a spy at one point?
Well, he told me he was a head spook at the military contractor that he worked for.
And do you think that was true?
Well, probably. Every Thanksgiving we'd get together and go out and have our Thanksgiving dinner with like five or six retired CIA types. So at least he knew them.
Did your dad ever tell you why he was so secretive about these recordings?
No. He wasn't very secretive with me about that. But he did kind of lean on the Benny Goodman, Helen Ward side of it. He didn't really broadcast much about Hawkins or Holiday or the other people. But I knew what was there.
Well, Helen Ward became his wife at one point.
Yes. They were married for about 28 years before she died.
When did you first become aware that your father had all of these recordings?
Sometime in the 80s. When Benny Goodman died, Dad had to get his stuff out of Benny's attic and garage before the family came and disposed of it otherwise. So he rented a station wagon and made a few trips between Virginia and I think it was Connecticut and hauled all his stuff back. And that year when I visited, I noticed that the lower living room was stacks and stacks of envelopes and various papers and things like that. Helen's piano had been moved to the upper living room. And they had all these boxes of things out in the garage. And that's when Dad started telling me what they were.
Well, did he play any of them for you? Were you a jazz fan yourself?
He didn't play them for me. What he did was... he would let me hear the digitized versions of some of the things that he was working on. But, they were very, very fragile recordings, and you didn't just play them like a, piece of vinyl. They only have a certain number of plays in them. He had to stop Benny Goodman from playing one over again because the solo was longer than Benny had planned for one of the other solos. And Benny kept playing that over and over. Just couldn't understand how he missed that when he was playing out. But Dad stopped him. And so, we're talking about really fragile stuff. And Dad did get one CD into production called Let's Dance. And it was Benny and Helen Ward, mostly. Pretty much, yeah, I think that was it.
Well, that's, as we said, it's because he's married to Helen, so I guess he felt that was important to do. Lauren, did you ever meet William Savory?
I met him once. I met him in the early 80s, probably 1980, when I went to work for Benny Goodman. I came aboard as an archivist and then eventually as his personal manager at the age of 21. A strange story.
You weren't playing with the band?
No, it was later on.
Because you are a really terrific tenor player.
Well, thank you. No, it was 4 years later that Benny actually took over my big band, and we became the last Benny Goodman Orchestra in 1984, 85, but that was later. In 1980, I went to work for Benny, and I met his circle of friends, and I met Bill Savory. And I just asked him because, this double LP had come out in 1952 called Jazz Concert Number 2. It was kind of a sequel to the Carnegie Hall concert. And in reality, it wasn't a jazz concert. It was Bill Savory's recordings. And they were phenomenal. Every one was a killer. And I just asked him, I said, how did you pick the best of what you had for that two LP set? And he said, I didn't pick the best of what I had. I picked the best of what was in the first box. And that began.
That's how you found out that there were all of these records.
Yeah. And that began 24 years of cultivation, which resulted in naught. But nonetheless, that's when I knew it. But just like Gene was saying, you know, we just assumed that they were all Benny Goodman. And I just want to take this opportunity because, you know, there's been a lot of media, and we're so thankful for this, around the century.
Well, this is an extraordinary trove of records.
I think it is. I mean, I think it's actually a major American find in a way. But I just want to say that the real hero here really is Gene, as far as I'm concerned, because Gene was the one, and I would love to hear him tell the story. Gene is the one who rescued them from oblivion. And if Gene Savory or De Savoret hadn't done that, we'd be here talking about a missed opportunity.
Well, before we speak to Gene about that, I am talking to Eugene De Savoret, the son of William Savory, who made all these recordings that we're discussing, and with Lauren Schoenberg, who is the director of the National Jazz Museum in Harlem. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Gene, were a lot of people trying to gain access, acquire these discs?
No. George Bakian had contacted me a couple of times, and he was advocating that they be donated. I think it was a university in New Jersey. I don't remember which one, Princeton, Tufts, or...
Is this the Rutgers, do you think, Lauren? No, because Dan Morgenstern
possibly
has that amazing collection.
Possibly. I think it's Princeton, yeah, though. I thought it was Princeton.
Well, it was one of those three.
Mm-hmm.
And then he called me sometime later. He wrote me an email, George did, asking me how I had been going along with digitizing them. And I just said, no, I'm not going to digitize these things. It's something that's a little bit out of my experience. And to become experienced, I may ruin some of them. Dad had gone over the procedure with me, and he even built a 16-inch turntable. And I had all the equipment there, but I just did not want to risk damaging anything, so I just let them sit. I heard of two physicists at Lawrence Berkeley Lab who, as a proof of concept, had come up with an optical disc reading system. And it would read the grooves in the disc without invasive things like styluses. So I said, that's what we need to use. And when Lauren called me, I told him, we need to use something like that. And Lauren said, yeah, I have access to it. And said, that's great, because you can even put broken records together with that.
Now, we should point out that George Avakian was a record producer at Columbia. In fact, he was a guest on this show many years ago, one of the most important figures in jazz history in his own right, especially his connection with Teddy Wilson and people like that.
Absolutely. And I should mention, on September 25th, we're doing a Saturday panel up at the Jazz Museum in Harlem where Gene is coming in, and George Avakian will also be on the panel.
Oh, great. Well, let's talk about this technology, because this is... These things were recorded off the radio, everything off the radio?
Yes, they were recorded on 10, 12, or 16-inch discs, mostly at 78 RPM, but the 16-inch discs were recorded at 33 and a third. This is back in the 30s.
Well, 33 and a third had been developed to make records of radio, live radio shows, so that they could be rebroadcast, because pretty much everything, the Jack Benny Show and all of that, they were all done live. But they were only designed to be played one or two times, and then they kind of disappeared. This is before tape was developed by the Nazis, wasn't it?
Yes, tape came into the U.S. In the late 1940s. This is all 1936 to 1940. And Savory, it's wrong to think of him as a recording engineer. I think of him as kind of a genius, kind of a Thomas Edison of his time. I mean, Gene is also a physicist, so he can talk about it. But, he was into all different kind of things, and the recording the stuff off the air was just one manifestation of his talent.
But radio didn't have high fidelity in those days. How did he get such good sound quality?
Well, yes, it did. actually. And when you hear some of these things, Leonard, you'll be shocked. It's a test. It's a tribute to the recording engineers on the radio stations of the time. There are some notes on the piano on these things. I mean, they're in a ballroom, and Teddy Wilson's playing, and he hits a low F on a really good piano, and this thing resonates. And, I mean, you know, say Bill Savory was doing nothing but recording in a direct line what was coming through the network. So I think that the problem with playback equipment in those days, both for 78s and for the radio, was that at home people didn't have high-tech equipment, so it didn't come through strong. But the signal itself was very good.
Now, we've mentioned the Benny Goodman recordings. Can we listen a little to one of those early recordings? This is from a concert January 16, 1938, which has been described by the critic Bill Ader as the single most important jazz or popular music concert in history.
That's
hard to say, isn't it?
A little hyperbolic there, but it's one of them, maybe.
But some amazing performances.
Yes.
Should we listen to a little of Benny Goodman and his orchestra playing Honeysuckle Rose?
Sure.
Now, we should point out that this is not a recording by Bill Savory. So why are we playing it?
Because it's actually a link to where we are today. What we just heard was Harry James's solo from the jam session on Honeysuckle Rose, recorded at Carnegie Hall January 16th, 1938. And in a very interesting coincidence, Helen Ward's then-husband, Albert Marks, had the concert recorded just for a historical memento. He made copies of it. He gave a copy to Goodman. Goodman put it in a closet. They found it 12 years later. He took it to Columbia Records and said, hey, I found my recording of the concert. Now that we have LPs, maybe you can put it out because the performances are too long. Columbia hired Bill Savory to do the transfer of this recording to LP. And it was the success of the Carnegie Hall LP that led to Columbia wanting to do a sequel album. They went back to Goodman, said, give us some more records. He said, I don't have any, but Bill Savory has some. So you see, it was a very important link there. That, frankly, the sound quality of the Savory things is exponentially
better
than what we just heard.
Gene, did you have any potential buyers for your father's recordings, or did you always plan on giving them to the Jazz Museum?
I didn't plan on the Jazz Museum specifically, but I knew I needed to get them preserved. Transcribed and preserved. And I was actually considering Northern Illinois University at about the time that Lauren called. And NIU is a very nice jazz program. It was original. The jazz program there was set up by Ron Modell. And they also have very good technical and computer departments. So when Lauren called and he said that he had access to the optical reader through the Smithsonian, I said, let's do something.
Were you surprised by just how many recordings there were when you started looking?
No. I was kind of surprised that Lauren thought he was going to get them all inventoried in 3 days.
And you didn't know that you were going to have to get a truck to bring them back to New York?
Yeah, we rented a Penske truck. We flew out there, me and two helpers, and spent a whole week pretty much, you know, all day for several days doing this. But I just want to mention just real quick that that we bought the collection from Gene and the estate, and one of our board members, Jonathan Scheuer, made that happen. And it was kind of funny because his wife, Deborah Granick, won Sundance this year for Winter's Bone. And then Jonathan was the producer of that. So it was a heck of a year for Jonathan with Winter's Bone and then kind of underwriting the Jazz Museum, buying the collection, actually, from the Savory Estate.
Gene, I want to thank you so much for being with us today. I've been speaking to Eugene de Savoy, whose father, William Savory, was responsible for the jazz recordings that we will be listening to for the rest of this this program and discussing. We're going to take a break, but stick with us because Lauren Schoenberg and I will be listening to a whole bunch of these records from the Savory Collection when we return. We're going to go out with something from the Savory Collection, one of the most remarkable recordings, Louis Armstrong, Jack Teagarden, Bud Freeman, and Fats Waller from 1938. They're playing On the Sunny Side of the Street. Wow.
Hello,
yeah. Wow, listen to that sound quality. That's extraordinary. Tell us what you think. In addition to leaving a comment on the website, you can also write on our show page wall or tweet us about this or any other segment. Just click on the Facebook and Twitter icons on our show page at WNYC.org. That's Bunny Berrigan playing I Got Rhythm.
Yes, sir.
With a bunch of black musicians.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of interesting, Leonard. Most integrated bands that made it into a studio back in the 30s, it was mostly a case of mostly white musicians, and they would bring in one or two blacks.
Like Benny Goodman, Teddy Wilson, yeah. Lionel Hampton.
Sure. That's how it mostly was. What's remarkable about that little sample that we just heard was there was, I know you know who Martin Block was, but Martin Block was a guy who played records on the radio.
Make-believe ballroom time.
Yeah, which was absolutely unheard of in those days. All the music was live, and people thought it was weird that a guy was playing records. The word disc jockey was actually invented from Martin Block. So to counter that, he started having live jam sessions in his WNEW studios, and that was from one of them. Two musicians from the Jimmy Lunsford Band, Joe Thomas and Trummy Young. Two musicians from the John Kirby Sextet, the pianist Billy Kyle and the clarinetist Busta Bailey. Slim and Slam, who had just had a huge hit with Flatfoot Floogie. And Slick Jones on drums and Bunny Berrigan, of all things. And they jammed. Now, what's fascinating is...
But that was Cozy Cole on drums, too, right? Did you say that?
I don't think Cozy's on that session. I think it's Slick. Okay. I think it's Slick Jones. I could be wrong. But what's interesting about that session is, I mean, these are... definitely musicians who didn't work together because they were all part of different bands traveling the country. And yet you listen to the music and it's all of a piece. And the backgrounds come in, the solos pop out, it has a shape, it has an arc to it, and it's purely improvised. I mean, it's just pure magic. Plus, Bunny does a version of I Can't Get Started that Dan Morgenstern, no less an august authority, in August 9th, 2010, said that he thinks this is probably the definitive version of I Can't Get Started.
Well, you have 975 recordings in all. How many of them have been transferred digitally so that we can hear them?
We've done 150, and there's this brilliant sound engineer in Brooklyn named Doug Pomeroy. And I want to mention that we will be going out to visit Carl Haber, who I've already been out to see in the Berkeley Sound Labs, because some of the discs will be good for that kind of transferring, not too many. But Doug Pomeroy has done 150, and they have filled up 15 70-minute CDs, and that's about one-sixth.
Well,
so we're looking at 90 CDs.
Well, our listeners can get a sense of what we're talking about because we have provided seven complete recordings on our show page at WNYC.org, including longer versions of I've Got Rhythm and On the Sunny Side of the Street, because all we can do is play little clips here now. Now, the track that – or the performance that has gotten the most attention is Coleman Hawkins playing Body and Soul. Now, Coleman Hawkins was a famous tenor player already when he recorded Body and Soul, and that became a breakthrough for him. Suddenly he became something larger than just the great tenor player with the Fletcher Henderson Band. How important was that recording of Body and Soul?
Well, it was important in two different ways. As you mentioned, you know, he was the feature guy in the Fletcher Henderson Band, leaves New York in 1934 and spends the next 5 years in Europe.
Because he didn't like what was happening in America?
Mm-hmm, absolutely. And he comes back in the summer of 39, and in his stead, Lester Young, Ben Webster, Chu Berry, Bud Freeman, all these great tenor players, Herschel Evans have come up. And the feeling at the time, now you have to remember, Hawkins at this time would have been 35. That's old for a jazz musician in 1939.
For a while, he was the standard by which everyone else was judged.
Absolutely. And he came back, and the thought was, okay, Grandpa has come back. So what does he do? He does two things. He goes and has an all-night jam session with Lester Young at Puss Johnson's Cafe in Harlem. And then he goes into the studio and, as he liked to tell the story, offhandedly recorded Body and Soul.
Well, we'll listen to a little bit of the famous recording. There was a time when a lot of people knew every note on that record by heart and could sing along, but he never really states the melody.
That's true. That was a best-selling instrumental 78 on the Bluebird label. And
on the pop charts.
Well, yeah. And
that's pure jazz.
Thelonious Monk, no less than Thelonious Monk, asked Hawkins more than once, how did it happen? How did this happen? The only way that I can answer it is, look, 1939 is a year in which a big popular pop tune was All the Things You Are. So clearly the ear of the adolescent pop-buying, sheet music-buying public of that day could take All the Things You Are and could take this Bach-like invention on All the Things on Body and Soul. Amazing.
Well, so he did. That's a three-minute recording.
Mm-hmm. He plays two choruses.
Tell us about the Savory version.
The Savory version was recorded at a place called the Fiesta Danceteria, I believe it was May 1st, 1940.
So this is how long after the
About 7 months or so, I guess. And even though the Bluebird record was a hit, I mean, its influence hadn't been told. It's like, let's talk about Huckleberry Finn a year after it came out. Nobody knew that it was, you know, that Ernest Hemingway was going to say, this is the book. You know, it was just a great book. This is just a great record. Now, at the end of the broadcast, the announcer comes on, which we won't hear, and he says, you know, live from the Fiesta Danceteria, New York's first self-service nightclub. I don't know what that means, you know. But anyway.
Mix your own drinks.
I guess so. There's a wonderful biography of Coleman Hawkins called Song of the Hawk by John Chilton. And in it, he says that Hawkins only worked about a week on this gig because the management wanted him to play Mersey Doats and all the silly pop tunes of the day. And he insisted on playing his kind of jazz, which puts this version in a very interesting context. Because here he is live on the air, and I'm sure that the owners of the Fiesta were pulling the hair out. He does four choruses of unadulterated, serious, fun, brilliant, swinging jazz music.
And that's about 5 minutes?
Oh, man, I think it's longer, Lenny. I think it's longer. And the way I hear it is it doesn't replace the famous Body and Soul. Nothing can. But let's say that we found a slightly longer version of Huckleberry Finn, and it had a significant extra amount by Twain that they didn't want to put out because people wouldn't carry a book that was that thick. That's pretty much how I look at this. It's expanded. I think it's as brilliant and ultimately maybe even better because it's just longer and deeper.
Well, we can't listen to all
it's deep
of it,
too.
But let's listen to a fair amount of it. Thank you. Well, there are obviously some references to the record, but it is a totally different performance. And I guess that's what makes the great jazz musicians great, that they don't repeat themselves.
Yeah, you know, what most people don't know about Mr. Lopate is that he's a serious tenor freak. And I know you are. So, I mean, I'd like to hear what you have to say about it. I mean, I've been talking about this record a lot recently, but I mean, yeah, I'm curious how it struck you, you know.
Well, the original Body and Soul has always been a favorite of mine. And I just loved the fact that it was this incredible, pure improvisation that became a hit record, a pop record. I can't imagine anything like that happening today. And then here you hear this great musician rethinking this material and coming up with new things with that gorgeous tone and very free. I guess there's a good reason that Coleman Hawkins later hired all of these bebop musicians and played with Thelonious Monk and did all sorts of things that other musicians of his generation would not have ever dreamed of doing. So it's a miracle.
Well, that's exactly what it is. And what's really further amazing about it is that somehow Bill Savory had a 12-inch disc ready.
Yeah. And I mean, knowing that it was going to go longer or just lucky?
I don't know. All I know is we found this disc, and it said Body and Soul. It said, you know, Coleman Hawkins, Body and Soul, May 1st, 1940. And I looked at it, and I said, you know what? I hope the acetate doesn't run out. Mm-hmm. I hope it doesn't come in the middle. I hope the announcer doesn't come on and plug, you know, Weetabix or something like that. And it just fits. And I imagine, see, because Bill Savory, like you and like me, was also a tenor sax freak. I mean, there's no accident that he has Coleman Hawkins and Lester Young in this collection featured. And I imagine that he was hanging out at the Fiesta Danceteria the night before. And he said to Hawk, hey, you know what? I'm recording this stuff on the broadcast tomorrow night, man. I'll buy you a drink, play Body and Soul and do it, and I'll give you a copy of it because it's just too much of a coincidence. I can't quite figure it out.
Well, there was another guy who used to follow Charlie Parker around, but he would only record Charlie Parker's solos, and yes. Out of context, it doesn't really make much sense. Here you have the complete performance, and, yes. And that's really important in jazz.
In exponentially higher phi.
And there's a lot to chew on in these collections. Not just the few that you sent me as for preparation for this interview. One of them is a live radio recording of Billie Holiday singing Strange Fruit. And this is at a time when Columbia would not record it. This is before she made the Commodore recording?
No, it's right after. In fact, the announcer, the reason that we can date it because it's an undated recording, is that the announcer is clearly plugging Strange Fruit and also her record of Fine and Mellow in a way that they only do when a record comes out. Mm-hmm. So it's fair to say that it's late 1939.
But this was a song that faced a lot of resistance. It was anti-lynching and it caused a controversy. You would have thought, at least in New York, that there wouldn't be problems. But the New York Post reported November 1939, station turned thumbs down a week ago but approved the number for last night's airing. Mm. Then it said no again, but has agreed to let Billy sing it tonight at 1 o'clock.
I wonder if that's this version. That's very interesting. I didn't know that.
Should we listen to a little bit?
Southern trees bear a strange fruit. Blood on the and blood at the root.
Just a little snippet, but in listening to these recordings, are you gaining an insight into the music of the time that you might not have had otherwise? Because we were only left with the official record, which is the recordings that have been available for a long time now.
Absolutely. The new insights into all these people, John Kirby, you know, Billie Holiday, they were free of a certain kind of restriction. You know, when you're in the recording studio in those days, you already referred to this, you know, there's this red light on and they're recording on a wax master. And I mean, there was specific pressure to take it easy. Don't stretch, don't go too deep. because if you make a mistake, it's going to cost the record company money. And so people kind of took it easy. Plus, I think also some of the artists, frankly, wanted to make the records a little cooler. So when they played it in person, then they could go berserk. If they went berserk on the record, then they'd have to do it in person all the time. And this is just one instance of that. Absolutely. I think that's a very important part of it.
Although after tape came along, you had things like Flying Home and 3 million choruses becoming very popular.
Yeah. A lot of folks want to hear more of this material, and I'm going to mention that.
Is it
going to
be released? That was my next question. And what are the copyright laws involved here?
Well, Tuesday evenings at the National Jazz Museum in Harlem, we're at 104 East 126th Street, and this is all listed on our website, which is jazzmuseuminharlem.org. We're doing four Tuesday nights on the Savory Collection, where you'll get to hear a lot more than these frustratingly short clips. But the reason of the short clips goes right into your question, which is that there's a lot of legal hurdles here. There's the artists involved, there's the musicians' union, there's the composers, there's the royalties, there's the publishers, and all different kinds of things. And the Jazz Museum, you know, it's run by me and by my co-director, Christian McBride, and we're both musicians. And, you know, we're not going to do anything to get around what has to be done legally. So right now we'll share with the public and in mass media short clips. We can play the material at the museum. We will. You can come in and listen to it, although we'll frisk you. And
because you don't want me copying or taping it myself.
Well, yeah.
But, and with the kind of modern equipment we have available, I could come up with perfect copies digitally.
Yeah, well, we'll make sure that doesn't happen. But we're talking with, frankly, all the major labels and some of the major reissue labels. And I'm just going to give you my word as one jazz fan to another, Lenny, that this stuff is going to come out and it's going to be accessible. I'm just where and exactly how, I'm not sure.
Well, it sounds like one of the most wonderful things to have happened in quite a while. And people aren't listening to swing as much as they did in the past because modern jazz and that the whole history going up through John Coltrane and today has become the dominant style. This gives us a chance to see just how great some of these musicians were. As I said earlier, there are 7 samples from the Savory recordings on our show page at WNYC.org. And Lauren, I want to thank you so much for coming by. Also, say again, thanks to Eugene de Savory, the son of William Savory, for his participation in our show. Lauren is the director of the National Jazz Museum in Harlem.
Thanks.